The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
What's up? My name is Zachary Bennett, and we're going to take 30 seconds from your podcast to tell you about Pets Life with a Z. Pets Life is a Minnesota pet care company that has created an oral care product for your cat or dog, or cat and dog, for those of you with both. It's 100% natural, 100% safe, and 100% guaranteed to improve your pet's oral health. Save hundreds in vet bills and improve your pet's health by visiting PetsLife.com. That's PetsLife.com. Enter the promo code Omaha and save 20% off every online order. Or if you're doing things by phone, mention Omaha and get that same 20% off any phone order. One more time, that's PetsLife with a Z, PetsLife.com.
Okay, we're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha on Twitter at Cold Omaha MN. You can also find this show not only on coldomaha.com, but on iTunes, on Libsyn. What else are we on? I got Tom Schreier behind the board here.
Google Play. Google Play, Stitcher. Just about wherever you find your podcast, there, I'm sure.
Got to get us on Spotify, too. I know Spotify's been doing some podcast stuff as well. But anyway, just about any means that you can get to and find a podcast, we're on it. Last week's show was a lot of fun having Twins right-hander Trevor May on. And we have a very interesting show today. We are going to be breaking down last night, or I should say this morning's, fantastic game between the Giants and the Cubs. It was game number 3 of a best-of-5 series. Went 13 innings, I believe it took until about 1:45 in the morning local time. And I'm going to bring in my guest here before we get too far into that, Matt Trueblood of BP Wrigleyville and Baseball Prospectus proper. Matt, how's it going?
It's going great. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. You were very complimentary of last week's episode, and I appreciate that. The check is in the mail.
Yeah, man. Trevor May is, they're this set of players who are famous for being thoughtful and interesting and funny. But I think if you're like a maybe reliever, maybe starter on a terrible team, you don't get as many chances to gain that fame, but he should be.
Yeah, I don't think too many people outside of Minnesota know much about him. Maybe Philly for the fact that he was a top prospect in their system, but he's very fascinating individual and went through some health issues this year, but when he was healthy, did a nice job. And so hopefully he can get healthy, move forward, and see what role he can grab here moving forward. Anyway, moving forward with the show, I do have to ask you, and I probably know the answer, but we're walking back through last night's game. I suspect you made it all the way past midnight and into the 1 o'clock hour for the end of the game.
Yeah, man, that's just getting warmed up time for me. it's just my internal clock anyway. So yeah, I was up until the bitter end.
And was that? I mean, you had to be up for work this morning. Is it just a matter of you not needing that much sleep or the necessity of staying up? Did you have to write the recap for it or anything like that? Or were you just kind of in there for the until the bitter end?
Yeah, I mean, I had enough, you do dad stuff around the house.
True.
Stuff. So I was working on that while it was going and then grabbed a few hours sleep and mainlined some coffee this morning.
So 13 innings, though, I mean, was there at any point in extras where you thought it was close to over, or were you just kind of holding on to the bitter end and hoping, maybe against hope, that they could pull out the road win? Because after the home run in the ninth, they went pretty quiet for quite a while.
Yeah, there was a stretch at which they were 1 for 27, and the one just happened to be this fly ball that snuck over the wall in the short corner. It was one of those games that starts to feel interminable just because neither team is doing all that much. And you kind of look at the lineups and you look at the pitchers on the mound and you go, I'm not sure why no one can hit these guys, but it also doesn't feel like they're right on the verge of it. So you've gotten to that point where you thought the game might just go on till morning.
And So Arrieta hits a bomb off Madison Bumgarner. I'm bringing that up here. Second inning, 378 feet to left field, scoring Addison Russell and Javier Baez. At that point, were you just feeling it, thinking, yes, three in a row, get the sweep, get everybody lined up, and get ready for, you know, whoever wins that Dodgers National Series? Were you pretty much rip-roaring, ready to go for the championship series?
You know, it was a big moment. It was definitely exciting. Playoff home runs, especially three-run homers, and when it's something quirky like it being the pitcher, it feels like, you know, momentum and all of that. But we also know that that's not usually real. And
you have it
until
you don't.
I knew, exactly. The big thing I knew last night was this is not 2015's Jake Arrieta. And I think maybe some of the national audience is still catching up on that, but this guy just is not, he's not able to maintain his command all the way through a game. The slider isn't quite as sharp. It started out great guns last night. He was throwing that slider in the low 90s in the first inning or two, and that was phenomenal. But we've seen a whole bunch of times this year he struggles against left-handed batters. He struggles the third time through the order. And when you just kind of played the game out in your head, if you were familiar with Arrieta's body of work this year, you kind of went, well, this is definitely not over yet.
And I've actually kept track of him pretty closely. It feels like, specifically in the second half, I know he hasn't been particularly good. And I use that loosely because his 75% is still better than a lot of guys, 100%. But it seemed to me like it was maybe somewhere in June he started walking like four guys in some games, and you know there were indications he wasn't quite right, and you know the fact of the matter is his ERA is almost double what it was, or it is double what it was last year. Again, keeping in mind the Arrieta standard that he set last year, what was going on with him this year though? From somebody who watched it closely, see, I would look at box scores and be like, man, you know, he's throwing a lot more balls than usual. He's walking a lot more guys than usual. He's giving up, you know, he might go four strikeouts, four walks, and six innings and only give up two runs. And that's good for the ERA, but it doesn't look like an Arrieta start. What did you see from him, you know, when he started to unravel a little bit this season?
A combination of things. The biggest being that his delivery is a little bit complicated. Relies on some timing syncing up just right and being able to stay upright through the early part of his delivery, and it can be tricky sometimes. He'll lose the feel for that on occasion. Another part of it is that for a chunk of the season, they tried to kind of, if not phase Miguel Montero out, rest him more extensively so that they could graduate Wilson Contreras into a truer starting catching role. Now, Contreras is a good player, great hitter, real good catch and throw guy, but he's not on Montero's level as a pitch framer, and especially at the bottom of the zone. Arrieta last year and even early this year was really able to nail that spot just the hat and just below the knees. Montero was getting him the calls on those pitches, and once that starts happening, batters are a little more prone to chase. It all snowballs. It kind of snowballed the other direction when he was working with Contreras earlier this year. The third thing is just that there is a little bit missing. It's maybe 5% off the stuff, but that 5% can matter, where for most of the season he hasn't had the absolutely unhittable, I'm going to call it a slider. You can call it sort of a cutter-slider hybrid. But that pitch has just not really been there for him this year. He developed a changeup last season that he's made work for him, but it's just not, you know, he doesn't have quite the arsenal, and the velocity is, on occasion at least, been a little bit down. So you mix all of those things together, and you just get a guy who was already working the edges and getting a lot of bad swings and bad chases. And once that stuff starts to slow down and the league adjusts a bit, he's still very good, but he's a little more prone to the kinds of things that we saw last night and throughout the second half.
And for all the lapses he had this year, for the lapse of a year that he had, Kyle Hendricks did his share to pick up the slack. I think what people might not realize, despite the shiny ERA, is he was actually very good last year as well. Looks like a guy who is, you know, he's a little better than average with strikeouts, doesn't walk anybody, better than league average ground ball rate. To me, when I assess the numbers, you're just looking at a guy who benefited from an otherworldly defense. But honestly, you know, a little higher strand rate, he wasn't drastically better than last year. Is that a fallacy, or are we pretty close to the pulse here?
No, that's close to right. He is better than last year's version. He last season, he essentially, in the second half, got rid of both his curveball and his four-seam fastball, just finding that they weren't really working. And so he simplified to this two-pitch approach. It was sinker, changeup, sinker, changeup. And he can cut his changeup, or he can fade it, which is impressive in and of itself. So he was getting by that way, with a little nagging or a little persistent nudging from one of the Cubs' pitching coordinators, Mike Borzello. He reintroduced the four-seamer and the curve this year, and has really become a four-pitch pitcher. Five, if you count both versions of the changeup, although that's quieted down a little bit. So there is a real change. He's also playing in front of the best balls in play defense ever. So that's, you know, that matters a lot too. It is, he's definitely a genuinely above average big league starter. The ERA lies a little bit, but there were real changes from last year. And even if you strip those away, what you have is this guy who, even though he kind of looks small on the mound, he's 6'3", and he's not throwing incredibly hard, but he's getting decent extension, and he's able to keep the ball down. The delivery is so simple. It's so low stress. If he can repeat it and he can maintain his command, which few people in the league are better at, he's going to be good for a long time.
And back to the defense for a second, and I suspect I know the answer, but who's your favorite defender on this Cubs team? And I think it's going to surprise people, but I think I know who it's going to be. And I think it's a certain someone who hit a home run that Matt Vasgersian went nuts for that barely got out of the stadium. Or am I wrong?
You have to ask me on today, and you have to ask me Thursday. You know, I might flip twice between now and then, but
sure.
I think Javier Baez is at the top of the list.
Yes,
now Addison Russell.
Javi was my guy. The tags, man. It's incredible how great he is at tagging people out.
The quickness on tags and flat-footed or just quick release situation throws. The velocity he gets is unbelievable. On a ground ball with the infield kind of halfway in Pittsburgh last year, he threw 95 miles an hour to the plate.
Wow.
When you have to pick it and fire to get a runner, you don't have time to load up. You're not supposed to be able to throw that hard. We saw a play that unfortunately didn't get tracked by StatCast, but he made a relay throw earlier this year to nail a runner at third on a would-be triple that I couldn't believe. I don't know where that arm comes from, but the tags, the instincts all over the field, they're really unbelievable. But Addison Russell, too, is he's a dancer. I mean, he actually is a very good dancer. but when he's at shortstop, he uses his body that way. You've seen those guys from America's Got Talent or wherever you might find them who can almost just lay themselves down on the ground and then pop back up. And it seems like they've got some sort of weight in their feet or something that's pulling them back. It doesn't look like they're using any muscles to do so. It's just so unbelievably natural. That's Russell. And between the two of them, they're the reason that the Cubs are this unstoppable or impenetrable defensive wall. Because you can move Baez all over the place, and wherever he is, he and Russell are going to complement each other. Russell's going to be moving toward anything hit remotely near him before it even hits the bat. They're special to watch.
Is it an embarrassment or riches to have Baez at second? I mean, is he a better shortstop than Russell, or is it just a deal where Russell's the shortstop and that's just how it is?
You know, it's a small sample. The numbers say that Baez is a better shortstop.
Okay.
I don't really want to stand here and go by the numbers. I would say I have generally held that I would, you know, in a completely perfect world, Baez at short, Russell at second, just because Baez's arm is a lethal weapon. Mm-hmm. And Russell's is above average, but it's just not on that same level. Russell, you know, it's hard to argue with him at short because the Cubs flipped him. Remember when they called him up last year, he was playing second base with Starlin Castro at shortstop. Mm-hmm. They flipped him to short in early August of last season. And since roughly that exact day, they've been putting up team defensive statistics that we've just never seen. So it's hard to argue with it just in that way. And Russell, he is so quick on plays where he has to slide or dive. Baez is a little less of just that smoothness on those balls that
the body
really
control
have to stretch for. Yeah, so he's maybe a slightly better suited to second and third. I think he's probably just a better defender overall because he's a more freakish raw athlete, whereas Russell is again fluid, smooth. These are the words that come to mind when you watch him. He's also just exceptionally well prepared and has great instincts for where the ball is going to be, how he can get there and make a play on it. Go ahead.
Back to game three. I'll let you finish if you have a point there. Otherwise, we're going to go back to game three here.
No, yeah, let's do it.
So Arrieta goes 6 innings, 97 pitches, Bumgarner 5 and 101. Were you left kind of wanting more from both of those guys? Again, it's hard to argue with lifting guys at those pitch counts. And, you know, with playoff baseball, teams will exploit how bullpens are built in this modern era. Or whatever you want to call it, as far as an era of bullpens that can strike everybody out. But maybe, you know, coming into the game, you're expecting a 7-inning duel between the two of them or something to that effect. Were you left wanting more from those guys when they left the games, respectively?
Not really. When you're just watching the way they actually pitched, Bumgarner's last, you know, the only actual runs he gave up, the only runs the Cubs scored were on Arrieta's homer. But he was increasingly working in some very deep counts. And the third time through, the Cubs were putting good wood on the ball. They just weren't able to turn that into hits or runs. And he gets up to 101 pitches coming off of, I think it was 119 against the Mets, which was as far as he's been stretched this mm-hmm. season. I think they kind of did what they needed to do there. And the Cubs, too, by weighted runs created plus, by true average, whatever stat you want to pick, they're the best offense in baseball against left-handed pitching. So Bochy had to be a little extra careful to go and get Bumgarner or to yank him maybe an inning before he otherwise would have.
Go ahead. What happened with Aroldis Chapman? Because, again, coming in the eighth, you know, it's a little unusual. And Alex Rodriguez actually on the post game said that he, you know, from their time with the Yankees, is a guy based on routine, based on, you know, it's something that's very important to him to stay in that routine. And so to get, you know, more than three outs in a save might be a bit of a risk. But from the video that they were showing, they would flash where the glove was when, I suppose at that time, was he throwing to Montero or Contreras? I don't even know.
Contreras.
Okay, so yep. He would have been throwing to Contreras. So it would look like Contreras would flash the glove low in the zone. And then, you know, when Gillespie hit that ball to center, the pitch was left up a little bit. Was he just battling location, or do you think there was something else at play with him, you know, with how much he struggled?
Well, I think the routine part's a little overstated. Chapman has said that he prefers to come in, you know, pitch one inning, make it a clean one, in and out kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He's also said he'd be willing to mix that up in the playoffs, and that was the Cubs' plan. I think the problem here was less that he had to pitch more than three outs, and more that it was the third time in 4 days that he was going to pitch, and yet he knew that there was this prospect of getting six outs to get any, you know, to finish the game off. and coming in with two on and nobody out. I think Madden got a little too cute there, and what he should have done was stick with Hector Rondon. Maybe if Rondon had gotten Hunter Pence, you know, then the next batter you can think about going and getting Chapman. But he started Chapman against Pence, struck him out, but it just seemed like he, whether it's fatigue or whether it's just, you know, sometimes Aroldis Chapman just doesn't have great command, and he can pitch around it because of his great stuff, and very well might have last night, except that Connor Gillespie kind of ran into one. But, you know, I don't think it was about routine as much as it's a third time in 4 days. The task just seems very daunting, and he just kind of got trapped into a bad situation. The Giants took great advantage.
Yeah, can't lose sight of the fact that if he lets Rondon get Pence, you're looking at, I believe, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 of the next 7 hitters would be batting left-handed. You got Gillespie, Crawford, Panic. I believe Crawford's not a switch hitter. Blanco, and then whoever hits for the pitcher, but then you jump up to Span and Belt. You know, it just lines up a little better. And again, even though he did get Pence, I think, you know, you're asking a lot out of a guy, like you said, that has thrown a lot. So, yeah, maybe one more hitter for Rondon might have been the better approach, and I think I agree with that take.
Yeah, and Hunter Pence is pretty fast, so you couldn't have exactly relied on a double play, but Pence is pretty prone to putting the ball on the ground against a good right-handed pitcher. Mm-hmm. Hector Rondon's very good at getting ground balls. You know, you might have been able to hand Chapman the ball and say, you know, strike this one guy out, and then we're already to the ninth inning. So,
and then he gets that clean ninth that he wants.
Exactly. I think probably worth sticking with Rondon longer. Madden had a little bit, sort of across the board, had an itchy trigger finger in every respect except for pulling Jake Arrieta last night.
And I suppose that's, in some ways, that's justifiable in the playoffs. You know, you're going to want to overmanage or be involved. But, you know, it didn't exactly pan out like he might like. So in the ninth inning, top of the ninth, Chris Bryant hits a 2-run home run. Off the bat, I did not think that was getting out. Did you?
No.
I thought it was a fly ball left, routine fly ball.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ball that can go sometimes. He hit it, I don't remember, but it was over 100 miles an hour.
I think it was like 109 or 107, something like that.
Yeah, Bryant can do that. He can kind of get around one, lift it very high, and hit it hard enough that it'll carry if there's anywhere for it to carry. At Wrigley Field, that ball is middle of the warning track, but it's kind of a shallow corner there.
It didn't seem like that bad of a pitch, frankly.
No, I think it ended up a little more middle than he wanted it to,
mm-hmm.
But where Bryant was, he still was reaching for it a bit, which is why it was not exactly crushed. I didn't think it was gone off the bat, but Bryant is able to lift the ball to the pole field a lot. That's how he ends up with so much power, and that's, you know, it better than anyone with Brian Dozier, mm-hmm. Jose Bautista. This is how the league is going about rejuvenating the home run ball lately. And so it's not crazy when you see one of those carry out. You couldn't have exactly expected it, but it's good process and ended up with a good result too.
So are you bouncing off the walls when that ball hits the top of that car and skips into the outfield, basically? Or into the stands,
was,
I mean?
It was a moment. Then you kind of had to go, well, Chapman's already out of the game.
Refocus. You got to refocus, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the offense, especially the top half of the order for the Cubs, has really struggled in this series around Bryant. Dexter Fowler's put together some good at-bats, but haven't had a lot of happy endings on those. Mm-hmm. Anthony Rizzo is clearly a little lost. So, you know, you couldn't exactly jump ahead and assume a win was coming. But they at least got new life and got to play on for a while. This is what the Cubs have done all year. Is they didn't play close to their best game last night. In fact, they haven't throughout this series yet. But when they're not playing at their best, because they do so many different things well, they're able to give themselves prolonged chances to win in just about every game.
So Albert Almora has been on my radar for quite a while. In fact, I watched him play on the USA U18 team here in the Twin Cities back. Actually, he was on the same team as Lance McCullers and Francisco Lindor, Bubba Starling, Blake Swihart, a bunch of guys who are either in the big leagues or at least pretty good prospects. And so I've known about him for quite some time, knew he was going to be a pretty great player. But I tell you what, that play in the ninth inning was absolutely incredible. You had to be feeling it at that point, too, you know, when the game comes that close to ending. Because if he doesn't catch that, you know, I think Belt is scoring pretty easily. At that point, are you just thinking, man, they're going to win this game, they're going to win this series, and it's going to be this next half inning because of you know, the emotional high they had to be riding at that point?
Well, you'd like to feel that way, but the way the Cubs' offense has been going this entire series.
Well, especially in that stretch, too. That was in the midst of that 1-for-27.
Yeah, exactly. Really, save for the pitchers, nobody's hitting especially well for the Cubs in this
yikes.
In this set. So you couldn't really make that leap. But it was definitely Almora, like you said, has been on the prospect radar a long time. Everyone kind of knows, or the our level of fan knows that mm-hmm. he's a great defender. The other thing that
he's a Cub after all, so yeah, he has to be.
Yeah, the other thing you learn really quickly about Almora is that he's got swagger for days. He's very poised. He knows he belongs there. He believes he's going to make every play like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of cool to see that happen for him. It's only going to boost his confidence going forward, I'm sure.
So Twitter was admonishing Brandon Belt's read there, but the broadcast was actually saying, yeah, that's what you got to do because you're trying to score that run. Where do you stand on Brandon Belt being, I believe, all the way around second by the time that ball was caught?
It's not what I would have, wanted to see my base runner doing. Just because maybe you don't score there, but if the ball does get down and it's going to be first and third, second and third, and one away, and Hunter Pence coming up, right?
Right.
That's not exactly a bad situation either.
So maybe you should be standing on second base instead of rounding it?
Yeah, I'm a little more... The conventional wisdom that has bubbled up around the game, and Joe Maddon is the biggest espouser of this, is that aggressiveness on the bases is good. Make the team make a perfect play. If they do, you tip your cap and move on. I don't buy that entirely, and especially when you've got kind of the middle of the order coming up or your lineup has really been working over the opposing pitcher throughout a given sequence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little more prone to say, if you don't get these next 90 feet, it's not the end of the world. You've got another guy coming up who's going to put together a good at-bat. Maybe it ends well, maybe it doesn't, but sometimes I'd rather take the chance with, I would have certainly rather taken the chance last night with Hunter Pence at the plate and a runner in scoring position, in fact, 90 feet away with less than two outs, than the chance that the ball drops with Albert Almora out there at the right fielder.
Yeah, so maybe if Andres Blanco or Joe Panik is up, you maybe take that risk a little more likely. Though granted, Joe Panik hit the ball basically right there on his walk-off. But but the point stands, as far as process as opposed to results, is that I think I agree. I think I might have had the guy standing on second base because if you suspect that Almora is going to dive, if he catches it, he's got to get up and throw. You've got a good chance to make it back to first. If it kicks off his glove and trickles in the corner, hits the brick wall, whatever, you've got easily enough time to get to third and probably still can score. So I think there's a middle ground between super aggressive, super conservative that might have made the most sense.
Yeah, and I don't know, I don't know how well the Giants had this gamed out. I assume in any playoff sequence that a lot of advanced scouting was done and hopefully it was communicated to the player. But Almora, for all his defensive weapons, it doesn't have a cannon arm. It's average.
Okay.
So, in that scenario you're describing where maybe he dies and the ball skids off the glove and trickles away, you're not going to have him firing it on the fly from the corner to the plate.
Not Cespedes or Puig or anything?
Right. Not even close to those levels. So he probably should have been a little more conservative there. But, in the playoffs, things like that happen. You end up taking chances, and Almora made the bigger play, just like Gillespie made the bigger play when he ran into that Chapman fastball.
So Mike Montgomery gave the Cubs, I think, four pretty strong innings of relief. How did you feel about his usage, especially him hitting in the 12th and, you know, being allowed to throw 57 pitches with Carl Edwards Jr., basically the last line of defense, but available in the bullpen?
Yeah. I didn't like it, but I do think it was defensible, just from the standpoint of, I'm guessing they didn't want to bring Kyle Hendricks back in any way in this game.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly could have, if it's true that despite being hit by that line drive, everyone said he was fine afterward. They could, in theory, have said, this is your throw day anyway. Go out there, give us a few innings. Because it's the playoffs and because it's a weird circumstance. If it had come to that, I would have rather seen David Ross pinch hit with the Giants having a left-handed pitcher locked in the game. But with nobody on and two outs, you can make a case that the chances of Ross extending the inning, or especially of homering, although he does have good power against lefties especially, just wasn't high enough to warrant that trade-off. I still probably pull that trigger, but the Cubs didn't feel ready to.
And so Ross ended up hitting actually later on and hit into a double play where the play at first came into question. Did you think there was any way they were going to call him safe? Because to me, watching in the moment, I thought it was pretty clear he was out. Again, I understand why these things get challenged because of
right.
the ramifications. But I, in the moment, watching the game live, sometimes you know you'll have that question, was he safe, was he out? I didn't really have any doubt in my mind, and maybe I'm not giving enough credit to how close it actually was, but I didn't think for a second they were going to call him safe upon the review, and I know there was some hand-wringing on Twitter and all that, but I thought he was pretty clearly out.
Yeah, if there was going to be anything, I think it was someone had pointed out that maybe Brandon Belt's cleat had slid off the bag, just like the Giants thought that Anthony Rizzo's had earlier in the game. I thought he was out, and I think it's definitely a play you challenge just to see, just because you don't know. But if Ross, one thing that the announcers got right was if Ross was able to go in there at a full stride, he might have beaten it out.
Yeah, he was kind of choppy at the end there.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty clear he didn't quite make it. And you can't fault Ross for that either. It's a, you know, it's not a fault of preparation. You know, the 40-year-old backup catcher, he's out there at nearly midnight trying to get down the line as fast as he can. He's not worrying about measuring his steps too much.
No.
So he did what he had to do. You don't want to see a guy pop a hamstring and then you're without a very valuable piece for the rest of this series and however many might be left. So yeah, it's probably worth a challenge, but I thought it was pretty clear he was out.
One of the Roto World guys said it was a bad slide at second base. I thought that was preposterous. Your thoughts?
Yeah,
it was a perfectly clean slide.
It was an aggressive slide.
But I thought
it was Contreras.
Yeah, it was perfectly.
He went
clean.
In real hard. He was clearly trying to the fullest extent allowable by the rules.
He very nearly did break it up too. I mean, it was a good
yeah.
job.
Yeah, no, he's got a big body and he used it, but it was all on the base. He didn't slide past at all. He didn't come inordinately up into the runner. No, there was nothing wrong with that slide.
So the walk-off, Joe Panik doubled to deep right, scoring Crawford. I felt like that was the slowest developing walk-off play I've ever seen in my life.
Well, the ball's got to fly a long way to get out to that part of the park. And then you just, any ball that is hit that far out there is usually going to have enough air under it where you've got to at least wonder. And so Almora tracks back there, but it bounced off higher above, and you saw Brandon, I think it was Brandon Crawford.
Yes, it was.
Anyway, the runner, he had stopped. He was being a little more careful than Brandon Belt had been. So it took him longer to score, too. Even once the ball ricocheted away, it cuts to him, and you kind of expected to find him on the verge of the plate, but he was just rounding third.
It was so weird.
Yeah, but you know, it was that Triple Valley makes for some weird visual plays.
So what's your level of confidence the Cubs still win this series? I suspect it's high, and I suspect it should be John Lackey going today against Matt Moore. And I think that even on the road is still a pretty good matchup for the Cubs. But is it a situation where you're still supremely confident, or are you a little sketched out by the fact that it's at AT&T and that, you know, it could be the equalizer today?
I think you have to carry just a bit of concern. You know, that was I was chalking up Game 3 as a loss when I kind of predicted the series. I said the Cubs would win in 5 just because I didn't want to concretely pick that they were going to win all 3 around what I thought was a pretty bad matchup in last night's game. They nearly won that one. And so that, in that sense, it maybe carries some extra frustration or whatever, you know, psychological toll. But ultimately, other than Montgomery, the Cubs' bullpen is pretty fresh. I think they'll maybe avoid using Chapman if they can. They'd love to build a big lead, but, you know, if they end up having to use him for one clean inning, I think they'll do it. Nobody else is taxed at all. Again, the Cubs are the best offense in baseball when a lefty's on the mound, and Matt Moore's a lefty, so you've got to like the matchup there. I still think, you know, it's probably it's certainly more than even odds that the Cubs are going to win the series at this point. It does still matter that they weren't able to finish the Giants off last night, just because if in a best of 5, your margin for error just is not that large. But I think they can still feel pretty good about where they are, knowing that even if they don't win tonight, which they're set up well to do, they're going home for the final game.
Have there been any, and this is separate of the series we're talking about here, playoff surprises for you at this point? I think for me, seeing a Cleveland team that starts Trevor Bauer and Josh Tomlin in 2 of 3 games cleans up on the Red Sox. Also, too, seeing Yu Darvish and Cole Hamels get smacked around, again, not by Toronto necessarily a surprise, but if you're Texas and those two guys get beat up, you really don't have much of a chance. Those are the two surprises for me to this point in the playoffs. Anything standing out for you watching these series, I suspect, pretty closely?
Yeah, no, the Indians sweeping the Red Sox is a huge surprise to me. If you'd asked me, I think I said the Red Sox in 4, but if you told me someone swept the series, I'd have been completely unsurprised and said, well, let's see who the Red Sox have next.
Yeah, exactly.
It just, their offense kind of went cold at the wrong time, which can easily happen this time of year. We've, you know, every year at least one lesser team dismisses a better team during the playoffs. It often happens 2 or 3 times. And I think it was that simple in this series. The Indians got by on the skin of their teeth with this strategy. I thought it was a little loaded up with risk for Terry Francona to just suddenly, all right, 40 pitches apiece from Andrew Miller and Cody Allen in game 1 mm-hmm. and in game 3. He was lucky to have an extra day of rest created by the rain out of game 3, which probably helped with that. But yeah, that was a surprise, but it was also fascinating. And the Indians and the Blue Jays, just the way they've gotten here, the style of play that they've each cultivated, and their manager's aggressiveness to this point, it looks like a really good ALCS.
And so I suspect, this is the last thing I got for you before we let you get back to work. I suspect I know who you have coming out of the NL to the World Series, and justifiably so. But who do you have coming out of the AL? Because honestly, I think a Cubs-Blue Jays World Series would be pretty lit.
It would be, yeah. The atmosphere in Toronto is just remarkable.
You take the good with the bad, frankly.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah,
You can't let one bad apple spoil the batch. But yeah, it is kind of a wild atmosphere.
Yeah, when you pack 54,000 people into a place, you know, I love the, you know, kind of cozy, the very intimate new retro parks, and even the old ones like Wrigley Field and Fenway. But there is a level of energy that you can get to with 54,000 people in a baseball-sized stadium, that 43,000 isn't going to match.
I feel like I saw really you tweet fun. That. I feel like field turf reverberates more vibe too. I don't know what it is, but
and when the dome is closed, yeah, I mean it just gets insane in there. So yeah, I also think Toronto's just given the Indians' current composition mm-hmm. with their pitching staff sort of in tatters, especially the starting rotation, I think Toronto's just a better team. So that's why I'm going to pick the Blue Jays, but why I will probably be slightly rooting for the Blue Jays or find it more fun if the Blue Jays win, it's got a lot to do with that, the atmosphere there, and just the surge, the roar that goes up whenever Jose Bautista or Edwin Encarnacion makes solid contact. It's crazy.
Yeah, give me a 7-game series between the Cubs and the Blue Jays. I don't care who wins. For your benefit, I'll say the Cubs, but I'll take a 7-game back and forth series with those teams to see both of those fan bases get all lathered up. I'd be pretty excited about that.
Yeah, hard to argue.
All right, Matt, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. We'll have you on again soon here. Maybe we can break down a Cubs win of the World Series here in a couple of weeks. Let's knock on wood for that. How about?
Yeah, sounds good, man.
All right, you've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.